Age.
Slingshot. Engage.
Engage. Hobie Call, dude. How you doing?
Hobie on the call.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, so I can't imagine many people don't know about you, but, you know, I'll admit we're a little past your era.
The amount of times your name is referenced, though, on Here to Party Sports is probably up there next to, you know, all Hunter's catchphrases. Like, at least one time per show. It's when Hobie Call and I were doing this and on the come up. So I'm excited to see who we're talking about after all these episodes and everything, too.
Well, I'll pass the ball to you. Did you know who Hobie Call was before you had met me?
You started referencing? No, not at all.
See, that's interesting. Hobie, do you mind if I go into story time just so we can paint a picture here?
Yeah, do it.
So let's go back, way back. It's 2024 in about a week. So this is 2011. I'm living in California. I'm a little bit of a lost soul. And I'm with all my friends, and we are just living in a house, a bunkhouse, partying, living up. We're all jocks, but we're nothing special. So I discover Spartan Race. I go, I tell everybody, I'm going to win this thing, blah, blah, blah. You know, obviously, that's what everybody probably says when they sign up for the first Spartan Race. So I go, and I do my little version of training, my own little training camp for maybe 8 weeks. So I found out about it in September, and it was in November. I think it was like November 11th or something. And I ended up running this thing. I took like sixth place out of 10,000 people, and I go through the results. I was like, whoa. And then whose name's at the top? Malibu Spartan Race. This guy named Hobie Call. And I'm like, what? And then I look at the times and everything, and I was crushed. I then at that point had to make this decision. My parents are begging me to come back home to go to college. And I'm like, I am not meant for classrooms. This is really a bad idea for me. So I had to go all in on something. Like, I needed to put my poker chips down on some kind of bet. And I basically, I sat there with myself. I was like, I'm going to go win this sport called Spartan Race, and I'm going to beat Hobie Call. That was the only thing that I could think of in telling my parents of what I was going to do. Because at the time, Hobie, you were actually Googleable. Like, that's a word now. You were the only thing that I could refer to when it was like, what is this sport? What are we going to do? You were the godfather. You were the Rich Froning. You were the Michael Jordan. You were the whatever you want to call it. You were the guy. You were the only person. And I didn't have the money to get posters, anything like this, but in my brain, I had painted every wall, every tree, every chunk of pavement that I ever ran on with a picture of you. And I created this quest, this journey to beat you. And I spent from 2012, when we actually competed shoulder to shoulder in the Sacramento Beast, first time ever. That was the first time we like raced against each other. Until I believe the last time we raced was in 2018. So we had a 6-year battle against each other, and I found out that you were going to retire. So I made sure that I came out of retirement for Spartan Race to go race you one last time in Tahoe. And, you know, anybody who's listening to this, like, I can honestly say that Hobie Call is the reason that Spartan Race became what it was. He was the first person to actually say, I'm going to be the best at this. And, you know, if it wasn't for that, there would be nobody to chase. There'd be no goals to set. And you did it at a level that I don't think anybody's ever matched since then. It's pretty astounding. So I want to give you a round of applause for getting my career started and also encouraging and probably an entire generation. Let's start the interview off and really kind of get into the weeds on this thing, because I want to learn about you. I mean, I spent more time probably studying you than any other human being on the planet, but I think that the more I learn about you and refresh my memory of who you are, the better and more better of a person I become every time I do some research. So I think all of us want to know the seed. Like, what was the day that Hobie Call knew that he was a runner? Was there a moment, a race, a day? Where did it all start?
Well, I was 10 years old. I had been running before. I actually tried my first marathon when I was 9.
Oh, my gosh.
So I ran from the time I was a baby. But it was when I was 10 years old. I still remember we lived in a really old church house, and I was in the gym in the wintertime running little circles around the gym. And I just had a moment where I was like, I want to be the best runner in the world. And that was it. I didn't want to be good. I didn't want to be great. I wanted to be the best. And that's where it started. So, you know, I lived in a small town. We didn't have internet back in those days. I didn't have coaches. I didn't know anything about nutrition, nothing. So all I knew was I like to run, and I like to run hard. So that's what I did. And, you know, I get through high school, and I barely was good enough to get a scholarship at a junior college. You know, I'm running college. I'm just doing what the coach tells you to do. And anyways, I'm about done with junior college, and I'm getting recruited by a couple four-year schools. But talking to the coaches, I realize none of these guys believe that I'm capable of being the best, and they don't believe they could train me to get there anyways. And so I decided, well, forget college then. I'll go train myself. So I actually dropped out of school and became my own coach for the rest of my life.
Out of curiosity, like, what was a good high school 5K for you? Like, were you guys doing 5Ks back then? Or was it 3K, 8K?
Yeah, I didn't have cross country, so all I ran was the 1600 and 3200, so basically the mile and 2 mile on the track.
Give us just like some time stamps that we could contextualize this whole thing.
Yeah, my PRs in high school, I ran a 428, 1600, and a 935, 3200. So by today's standards, there's nothing amazing at all. I mean, it was real high altitude. I lived in Wyoming and ran half my races in snowstorms. So didn't exactly race in the best of conditions, but you know, like I said, it was barely good enough to get me a scholarship to a junior college. So I wasn't slow, but I certainly wasn't fast, especially by today's standards.
I was really not that good of a runner either. I mean, I was good, but not great. I was in a similar position as you. Nobody was like losing their mind. And you get to college, and I mean, I was in a similar position. I didn't want to study. I wanted to get fit. And obviously the coaches didn't think I was special either, but it was more because I had gotten in a lot of trouble, not because of just my talent.
Yeah.
Out of curiosity, like when you were amongst all those other athletes and you're seeing all these big times being put up, did you ever doubt yourself, or you were just sitting there being like, I don't know if I got what it takes? Cause you said from the start, like you wanted to be the number one guy. And now all of a sudden you're racing against all these other people in the state, and you're starting to see other people's times in the nation. Like, you clearly weren't the best person. Like, what was that like?
You know, it didn't faze me at all, actually. Maybe I was just too dumb to know better, but I was still like, I'm going to figure this out. I got my whole life, you know, I'm still young, and I'll figure it out. I'll find a way. So it was quite the journey. And honestly, strict running really wasn't my thing. I thought it was. I thought that's what I was going to do.
Yeah.
But I never, you know, my 10 years later after college, my best PR and everything, like I ran a 2:16 marathon, which, like I say, isn't bad by any means. But by world standards, I was 10 minutes behind the world record guys, you know. 10K, I only went under 30 minutes a few times. That's nothing special at the elite standard.
Yeah.
You know, but I kept trying. I still believed, even 30 years old, I still believe, and I was still going at it, giving it everything I had, thinking, oh, I'm still going to find a way. I don't know how, but I'm still going to figure this out.
So you had to eventually probably have a conversation with yourself where it's like, this is all I got to change. Like, I gotta find some kind of hack. I got to make some kind of magic plan. You know, I know that you always had some very odd training modalities where you would use weight vests, you use different kinds of training that wasn't typical to this like really high mileage stuff. You know, but I before we get into the weeds on that, like I want to know, when you left college, where did you go back to first? Like, there had to have been this jump where you're all like, all of a sudden I need to get onto the next raft to float on for a bit. What was that after college?
Oh, it was 20 different things. I felt like I was the Wile E. Coyote, you know, and always trying a new thing to catch that Roadrunner, and it always blew up in my face. So I'd go back to the drawing board, try a new plan, it blew up in my face, but I'd take what I could learn from each one of those moments. And honestly, I mean, I didn't get horrible results. I did end up running a 216 marathon.
How old were you when you ran that 216?
I was actually 30. I was 30 at that point. And then shortly after that, ran the Olympic trials, where I just had one of the worst races of my life. And that was where everything actually changed. That's where I said, you know what, this isn't going to work. I obviously have weaknesses and shortcomings in my body. And I thought, I'm just going to go and completely revamp everything. And that's when I started training with a weight vest, doing the lower mileage and things like that. I was like, I'm gonna make every single muscle and tendon and ligament in my body bulletproof, so that as I build, I won't keep hitting a ceiling. I'll be able to just improve, because I'm not gonna have any weaknesses. Yeah. And so that started the type of training I did more for obstacle racing, where I was just wanting to build a bulletproof body where I could just run hard as you can imagine with a 40-pound weight vest on and feel good doing it. And so that's when things really changed. I really nailed down my nutrition and all those things, and that's when a whole different world of results came into play. And I was still heading for the marathon until all of a sudden this thing called Spartan Race showed up on my computer, and that's where everything really changed.
So I figure I want to keep in the weeds here for a second on some of this post-college stuff. Now, you and I had like a very, this is what I think made us interesting friends and also interesting competitors. I was very into partying, as you know this, and I had a little bit of a rambunctious lifestyle. It seems like you're a family man. You got five kids. Like, when did Irene come into the picture?
Oh, I met Irene in college.
Right, that was a short-lived day. So how long did you last in college for?
I was actually in college for almost 2 years.
Yeah, me too.
Yep. So yeah, I actually dropped out like 2 months before our graduation. So maybe not the smartest idea, but like I say, running was my goal, not college. So it didn't matter to me at the time. I got Irene, and we got
married shortly there afterwards.
We actually got married just before I dropped out of college. So really, I went to college to run and to find a wife, I guess. Because as soon as I had my wife and realized that wasn't where I wanted to stay to run, I was out.
You got good at getting married and shitty at running.
Right.
So that's got to be an interesting position. So you got married very young. And I it's very uncommon these days to see that kind of thing. You know, were you at all ever challenged by the idea that you are now supporting a plus one and also going after all these endeavors? Or did it feel really awesome to have a plus one while you were going after all these endeavors?
You know, I always knew I wanted to be married. I always knew I wanted to have kids. Like, I just didn't even put that into the equation. I said, yeah, I'm married. We're going to have kids. And we did. We, you know, within a couple of years, we had our first. And then we just kept having kids after that. And did it make it harder? Absolutely. A lot more sacrificing. Absolutely. But to me, I never told myself I can't do both, which, you know, definitely harder. But to me, that made it so much sweeter, because I had people to share it with. You know, without my family, without my wife, all the accomplishments wouldn't have meant nearly as much. But not only that, to be honest, without Irene, I never would have run a world championship at a Spartan race. I might not have even showed up to the first Spartan race. Like, she played a role in making all that happen. It never would have happened without her. So,
awesome. So
even though in some ways it was harder, it wouldn't have happened without it. So it goes both ways. But I never looked at it as something that was going to stop me.
Well, we're totally opposite, dude. I've had 100 girlfriends and I have 100 ex-girlfriends, if you know what I mean.
You're just one closer to the right one. Don't worry, you're getting
That's
there.
That's right, dude. So I want to get into the, like, I want to learn more about that. So I remember reading an article just now that, like, you know, you talk about never taking your kids camping, and it wasn't because you couldn't necessarily afford camping, it's because you couldn't afford the time and the workouts. You had to stay focused. And you know, I've met your kids many, many times, and I don't think I could sit down with any of them and be like, tell me one bad thing about your dad. And I couldn't, even if I held a gun to their head, they couldn't come up with one bad thing. And it's pretty amazing where, I'm so used to the culture of people being like, oh my God, I can't work out when I have kids. You have no idea how hard it is. This, that, excuse. I'm getting fat, blah, blah, blah. You can't do things when you have kids. Like, you became a multiple time world champion, did a ton of amazing things. You traveled with your kids. Like, you know, you use the word sacrifice, but it seems that everybody was pretty aligned with what you were doing at a level that I've never seen before. You know, you got 5 kids, you got still a great relationship with your wife. Were there times in there, like, you were sitting down to yourself being like, I don't know if I'm making the right decision? Did you have regrets, or do you feel really comfortable with the way it all worked out?
And how do you manage that workout time and spending time?
Well, I mean, there's definitely sacrifices. Don't let me kid you into thinking there's not. There were sacrifices made, and yeah, it was a struggle, but we approach things different than a lot of people. A lot of people have kids and they start living their kids' lives, you know, and we were different. We had a kid and we brought a running stroller, and instead of staying home with the baby, we brought the baby running with us, you know. And then, you know, years go by and one of my sisters was like, Irene and Hobie, you guys are so weird. He's like, everybody has kids and the parents live vicariously through their kids' lives. She goes, you guys are totally the opposite. You just keep living your life and your kids are living vicariously through your lives. And she just thought that was the strangest thing in the world. And I don't know, I guess maybe it is, but my idea is, like, we still have our lives. We still have our dreams. Go for it and just bring our kids with us along for the ride. And for us, it worked out great. And I think our kids enjoyed it. And I've all grown up without any issues about it. So it seemed to work for us, at least.
It's pretty awesome. Was there ever a level of pressure where you were like, I don't know if I'm going to make it? I'm putting these kids in a tight spot.
Well, I was Spartan racing, there's actually a lot of that. You see me on my good days, but yeah, that's 10, 15 days of the year. There were plenty of times I was heading off to a race thinking, if I don't win this race, I'm calling back my old boss and going back to work. You know, I mean, that, like, literally, no joke. There was probably at least a dozen or two times where if I don't win, I can't even come in second. Like, I have to win or I'm calling back my old boss and I'm going back to work. And, you know, it was quite the roller coaster ride, but we made it work out. That's totally what
was the funding of your entire salary, these races that you were showing up to on the weekend? Or did you had your weekend races, monies, and then like a side hustle and everything going on for like collabing? Obviously, you know, you had maybe spousal support with wife income maybe, but the whole lifestyle.
Yeah, it was kind of half and half. There was a few years where I was working a full-time job. Mm-hmm. And most of the time Irene was home with the kids, and that's what she did. Sometimes she would work some here and there. But yeah, I had a full-time job probably 4 of those 7 years, regular full-time job. Now, the other 3 years we managed to make it work through obstacle racing, different avenues and that. So it was a lot of both. But wow. There were some months where we're like, we're doing pretty good. And there's other months where we're like, we literally don't know how we're going to pay our rent 3 weeks from now. So it was quite the roller coaster ride.
So you have this moment, you're 30 years old, you blow it at the Olympic trials. What happened at the Olympic trials?
You know, I still don't know. I feel like it was just pure destiny was supposed to happen. Cause I went in the Olympic trials thinking, this is it. I'm 30 years old. I've given it everything I've got. Either I'm going to do well enough to make it in the Olympics, or at least well enough to get sponsored, so at least my running funds itself, or else I'm done. Like, that was my attitude, and I was pretty serious about it. Well, I had such a bad race that I come home and I actually got depressed for a while. When I snapped myself out of that, I got angry and I thought, I did not work this hard for this long to go out like that. I refused to quit. So just pure raw anger fueled me for the next year. as I revamped my training and started running with a weight vest and all that kind of stuff. And I was just a madman. I was mad. I was so determined. I was like, I am not going out like that. No way.
What was that? How bad of a race was it? Would you run?
Yeah, what were you running?
I didn't finish. It was strange. I thought I was sick. Because the first 4 or 5 miles was fine. I was up there doing good. And then my bike just started slowing down. Every mile just got a little slower. Everybody's passing me. By mile like 11 or something, I was literally just jogging. It wasn't even close to a race pace. And I didn't even know what was wrong. I thought I must be sick. I'm just not feeling it yet or something. So I ended up dropping out about halfway through the race. And yeah, I was just perplexed and bewildered by it at the time. But then afterward, I didn't get sick. I felt totally fine the next day. I was like, what the heck's up with that? And so I don't know. It was just a really strange day. Like I say, I think there were other forces at work saying you can't quit. So I can't let you have a decent day because then you'll quit. So the fact that I had such a bad day is what fueled me to not give up. So looking back, I'm glad it turned out how it did, because if I would have went and ran a 2:22 or something and came in 10th place but not get any sponsors, I probably would have just quit right there and never would have showed up to that first Spartan race.
You know what started my entire path to starting my supplement company was that race against you in 2013, where I was leading briefly at a mile 8, 9, or 10, and I started cramping up in the woods. I didn't know about nutrition. I didn't know about hydration. I didn't know anything. And I'm dying there in the woods. And I was like, this doesn't make any sense. Like, how could I have spent so much time in the gym and so much time climbing this mountain, and now I'm losing? Like, this has never happened to me before. And I couldn't figure it out. And, you know, from that point on, I said, I'm never going to let this happen to me again. And it became this massive obsession. I'm curious to hear about like what your obsession became. Like, how did you decide to pick weight vests? And what was this? Was there some kind of book that you picked up? Was there some kind of just like, I don't know, moment where Jesus hit you with a light beam full of information? Like, what started this new path of training? Like, how did you decide that this was going to be the new way to go?
Well, like I said, I wanted to develop a bomb-proof body. So I wanted to really strengthen my muscles and my ligaments and tendons and everything like that. So you need, you know, extra resistance training for that, unless you just want to run a million miles a week. But that doesn't really get those types of results. So I thought I need resistance, but I don't want to mess with my biomechanics, because the biomechanics and efficiency in running, you know, depending on how you run, like you can do lunges and that'll work some of your muscles, but it doesn't directly translate well to running. You can cycle, that works some muscles, which will translate somewhat to running, but not completely. You know, the weight vest is the only resistance tool that doesn't change your biomechanics at all. You can run exactly with the right form and cadence and everything with a weight vest on as you do without it. So it's the only form of resistance training for running that doesn't change your biomechanics at all. Yeah. And so it makes it the perfect resistance tool. So that's why I did that.
Did someone tell you that, or were you just like, this is it?
No, it was my years and years and years of research and trial and errors and study that, you know, I realized that was the truth. And so, no, I came on that on my own.
Weightvest.com probably owes you about $10 million. Because I remember I went to weightvest.com because you had a weight vest and I bought my weight vest. Yeah. Now I have half a dozen weight vests. Someone stole the weight vest I bought from weightvest.com, so that's heartbreaking.
Well, been your best one.
Yeah. So why not heavy weights? Like, I would always watch you and you'd have these like upper body routines on like a Bosu ball with pull-ups and dumbbells and weight vests, like lunges and push-ups. And then you had your lower body day and then you had your tempo day. I don't think I've ever seen you lift heavy weights.
No, I mean, the only advantage that might have done for me is in something like the tire flip. But other than that, having, you know, you want to have a little bit of extra strength, a little bit of extra endurance, a little bit of extra speed. But if you take it too far, then it becomes unbalanced with the rest of your training. So if I would have done like super heavy curls or something like that and made my biceps a full pound bigger than they needed to be for anything. That just means the rest of the race I'm carrying around 2 extra pounds where I don't need it, where it's of no use to me. So it'll actually slow down my running. So heavy weights creates a little too much bulk, and then it just slows down the rest of your race, where it might be an advantage for 10 seconds of a tire flip, but that's a disadvantage for the rest of the hour and everything else you're doing. So I made sure I was strong enough to do everything I needed to do. Just a little extra strength for almost everything else, but too much strength ultimately hurts you throughout the whole race. So
big you're enough, talking but not to the man way. with the trademarked phrase biceps win races, adding extra two pounds to the thing. We got a very, very difference of opinion here on biceps.
What we call There's no question.
The million anomaly here. He's an exception to the rule, and that's why he impresses all of us so much. Because we're wondering why a 200-pound guy can run up the mountain with us, but most people can't do that.
Hobie is the reason why biceps and races was created. I had been racing against Hobie now. I think this was in 2014 that I finally beat him for the first time in a Spartan race. I had beat him in a superhero scramble about 6 months earlier. And then we were racing on my home turf again, the first one I'd ever done, the Malibu Spartan race. And he was just always about 10 meters ahead of me. Mm-hmm. I could hit him in the head with a rock. I should have probably. It would have been a lot easier. And he was always just about 10 meters ahead of me. He comes in, he gets on the, we get into like literally the foreground where like the arena is happening, where everybody signs up for the races and puts their pack of pickups and everything. So there's a mob of people. And it had been raining the night before, so everything was soaked. So he gets on the rope, and he's about halfway up the rope. I start going up the rope. He comes down, and now he's got his hands on the Hercoist. If anybody doesn't know what the Hercoist is, it's a pulley system attached to a rope with 2 to 4 of the Spartan pancakes that weigh about 50 to 70 pounds a piece. So it definitely wasn't 4 of them, but it was enough that it should have been around like 100-something pounds. And it was so full of mud. I watched the thing come up off the ground, maybe a yard for Hobie, and he was just stuck there. And I was like, this is my chance. So I gun it, and I just start ripping it with my arms, and I get all the way to the top, and it was hard. And I get across the finish line, and it was the first time I had beat Hobie, and I flex, and I just, some lightning bolt struck me, and I just said biceps win races, because it was my arms that won the race. It wasn't my legs. Hobie would have beat me in a foot race every day of the week. Still to this day, probably, but you're also another reason that you've created my entire, like, you know, my entire brand identity. So I got to thank you again for that. You know, I want to know more about the weight vest stuff, because I have messed with weight vests on and off my entire career, and I do like them. They're not my like, I've always been more of like lift as heavy as you can and then do as much, like, you know, as heavy as you can and then find out the way to be a freak endurance athlete. You're a freak endurance athlete with very specific spikes of, you know, the weight vest training. Just to give everybody, like, give us a primed week of what your training looked like back when you were like in the 30s to 40s. Like, what was like a ideal week for you Monday through Sunday?
Oh, my first few years as Spartan were pretty much identical. Monday would be an upper body day, just a huge upper body circuit, nonstop exercises, get your heart rate up and just go from exercise to exercise.
20, 30, 40 minutes?
It lasts about 40 minutes. Yeah. Yep. It lasts about 40 minutes. Tuesday, I would do 3-minute intervals on the treadmill with a 30-pound weight vest. I do that around 5-minute mile pace, I think is what it was, with 1-minute rest breaks. And then I'd go and do a bunch of lunges. So I do a few sets of heavy lunges with, like, usually I'd start with 80 or 90 pounds and then do a few lunge sprints real fast and hard without any weight. Wednesday is the same upper body day as Monday. Thursday, I do 6 1-minute intervals on the treadmill with a 40-pound weight vest with a 20-second rest break. So real short rest breaks, real high intensity.
What was the pace on that?
I don't remember during Spartans days. I ultimately got down to 4.5-minute pace at my very fastest. I think while I was doing Spartans, it was closer to 5 minutes. But yeah, with 40-pound weight vest on, though, that's moving pretty quick. And then the lunges after that too. So I always run with the vest and then do lunges afterward. And then Friday, sometimes it'd be a rest day if I was feeling worn out. Otherwise, it'd be my upper body day again. And then Saturday, I'd go out in the hills and run 6-minute intervals, usually 5 or 6 of them, out in the hills with a 10-pound weight vest on, with lunges as my rest breaks. So I'd do a 6-minute interval and then do 30 lunges and then 6-minute interval, 30 lunges. So just nonstop for the whole workout like that.
And you did that week after week, month after month.
Yep, for three years during Spartan, for like a year or two before that, actually, even. So for about 5 years, that was my rhythm.
Did you have like 3 weeks on, 1 week off, 5 weeks on, 1 week off, 10 weeks on? No down weeks.
No, the down weeks were race weeks. I'd taper for the race, and then I'd spend about half a week recovering from the race and jump right back into it. So the only real rest breaks I got was right before and after races.
How old are you by the way? 42, 43?
46. I'm getting
You're
up 46?
There. 46?
Yep.
Jeez, man. So
I know it's been 6 years since I retired. It's crazy.
Wow, dude. It is flying by. That's freaking me out. Because I met you when you were my age. You must have been 34.
Yep. I was 34.
You were 34. And I mean, I'm stronger than I've ever been. Like, I could rip the bark off of a tree with my bare hands, and I can run up mountains like just like a horse. But I will admit, it bites back a little bit more. And I don't know if it's because I can swing harder. So the reverberation, like, you ever hit a hammer against like something really hard and the reverberations come back in your arm, you're like, ow.
Yeah.
Like, I can't tell if it's that kind of physical response where it kicks back more, or if old age just is taking more time. Like, where did that start to become part of your conversation?
Honestly, shortly after I turned 30, but when I started training smarter and focusing better and making sure I'd take power naps during the day and got my nutrition down better, that definitely extended my longevity by a solid 10 years.
Solid.
So as nutrition and all that got better, I think when I was 40, I was as fit as I had ever been, probably.
What was your fittest year?
I'd probably honestly have to say the year before Spartan started, maybe 2 years before Spartan started. 2009, I did the most impressive workouts of my life, for sure.
You're 32. But,
so, yeah, 30, yeah, 32. 32, most impressive of my life. I never quite got back to that during obstacle racing. I'm pretty close, though. I mean, it was close, but I never could do the workouts I did when I was 32 again.
It's interesting. I think in 2022, I was in better shape at High Rocks World Championships than I was last year. So I was 32.
In Vegas? But
in Vegas. But I think I just not done the strategy as well as I do now. I ran the race differently. I was doing things differently. But a couple of years ago, I was 196 pounds, and I was probably like a 30, 31 high, 10K guy, deadlifting 500 pounds in the same day. Like, no problem. I was just an animal. But I don't know. I don't know if I've reached my top. Out of curiosity, what was it like with nutrition? Like, this was one of the more interesting things I learned about you. I remember, like, your Hobie Super Shakes, and I would be, like, trying to write it down on a napkin, and I'm like, what is all this crap this dude's talking about? Like, he's got wheatgrass. He's got honey. You also got me on my honey obsession. I eat probably about 2 to 3 pounds of honey a week. No joke. And people think I'm a creep. People think I'm a creep.
Same here.
Why are you eating so much honey? I'm like, stick to yourself, man. Keep on drinking your creepy, like, you know, pumpkin spice latte. I'll just drink black coffee with 3 to 5 tablespoons of honey in it instead. What was nutrition like? What was like, you know, were you keto? Were you carb heavy? Were you all organic? Hit us with some like big identifiers with your nutrition.
Well, my nutrition was a lot like my training in the early days where I was the Wile E. Coyote and I tried everything. You know, it all started when I was a teenager. I used to get headaches and stomach aches really bad. It was so bad that my period in school after lunch, I'd almost fail the class because I just had a big stomach ache and headache. And I didn't have a clue why. It turns out I was really lactose intolerant. So I finally come across a book and read it, and I'm reading about lactose intolerance and what dairy will do to you. I'm like, man, that's me. And I'm like, oh my gosh. And so I'm like, I'm going to quit trying to eat dairy and see what happens. So I quit eating cheese and milk, and all of a sudden I felt great. And I was like, it just blew my mind that what you eat has the potential to make such a difference in how you feel. You know, so some people who are lactose intolerant see that as a bad thing. I saw it as a good thing, because if I didn't have it, maybe I never would have really gotten into nutrition. But since I had such big problems, and that's what got me interested in it. So that's where my obsession with nutrition got started. And then it just continued to grow. Like my early 20s, I'd go and I'd have bathroom issues during races all the time. During the middle of a race, I'm like, oh, I gotta go, I can't help it. So it's messing up my races. I had to figure out something. What could I eat before a race without it messing me up, so that I got good energy, but it's not making me need to go to the bathroom. And so that's where all my wheatgrass drinks and all those concoctions started coming into play, because I used to just eat a bunch of fruit before a race, but that doesn't go well.
All right, let's get the wheatgrass cocktail. I'm gonna put this down in my notes. Everyone wants to know about the Hobie Call wheatgrass cocktail. What is it?
I got lots of different variations depending on what time of day and everything, but the most popular one is probably the pre and post workout.
Which
usually will have wheatgrass. It'll have like wheatgrass juice powder usually, because the juice powder will digest quicker than the whole leaf with the fiber in it. So wheatgrass juice powder, raw honey. Usually I'll put creatine in it, creatine monohydrate. Let's see. Off the top of my head.
See, look, guys, Hobie Call takes creatine. You should listen to the champ.
That's right. You only want Creapure from Germany, though. Don't get any of that garbage that coming out of China. So Creapure, no. if you really want to know, if you're interested. So creatine, raw honey, wheatgrass, and usually I'll do like a hydrolyzed whey protein usually, because you want it to digest real fast and easy. So good quality hydrolyzed whey protein. So those are the four basics right there. So that's usually what's in the pre and post workout. Oh, that's right. Now I do Shilajit, of course, too. Supercharge it with Shilajit. So
since we're on the subject, I was gonna allow you to get into this later, but I want to stick to this. We're coming back to Shilajit because it's gonna take some time to digest that one.
Yeah.
Tell us about the strength to weight ratio. That was something that always fascinated me. What was your average weight in Spartan race when you were racing most of your career?
Oh, usually between 140 and 145.
140, 145. To give people some context, I raced Hobie at 195 to 205 my entire career. That was crazy. Okay, so tell us about just a daily average to fuel that. Thousands of calories. Like, do you have any of those kind of metrics? Do you know what you were eating on a daily basis?
I didn't actually count the calories per se. I quit doing that many years earlier. But no, my diet was super strict. It'd be almost the exact same thing every single day, especially until dinner. Like, I get up in the morning, you know, 4:30, because I got to get to work early. So just before I leave at 5 o'clock, I'd have one of my those wheatgrass drinks, but instead I'd put raw eggs in it, and I'd put oil in it and everything too, along with those other ingredients, just to give it more long-lasting energy and to add calories to it. And then I have another one of those drinks, pretty much the same thing, sometimes with chia seeds added to it also, you know, just really build it up with other stuff. At 8 o'clock, and then at 11 o'clock, I'd have lunch, which would be another one of those drinks, and then maybe a tortilla or pancakes or something like that with it. And then I come home and then I'd have that pre-workout drink we mentioned before my workout. Then after my workout, I have a post-workout drink, same thing, just more sugar usually added to it. And then for dinner, that's where things get mixed up, you know, have pancakes or spaghetti or just whatever we're having for dinner, that kind of thing. And then usually before bed, I'd have another one of those wheatgrass drinks with a bunch of raw eggs. So I was eating 6 to 7 times a day. So generally smaller meals, but a lot of them.
And that was all shakes
every day for years. Like, I'd have 6 to 7 of those wheatgrass drinks every single day, years on end.
So it doesn't sound like you eat a lot of meat.
I'll have sometimes I'd have meat with the lunch, and then I'd usually 50% of the time I'd have some meat with dinner. So not a ton of meat, but I do have some, but I do eat an awful lot of raw eggs. I would average six, maybe usually I'd average about six raw eggs a day in those drinks.
You prefer shakes, I guess, over to like whole meal or whole foods. And that's worked really good for you, huh?
Yeah. And it's whole foods I'm putting in the shakes. Like wheatgrass is a whole food and eggs are a whole food and chia seeds are a whole food. So I put those things in the drink. But definitely drinks in general, they help keep you hydrated. They digest easier. They digest faster. The energy is easier to get out of them. You know, you eat a big steak, you know, you spend a ton of energy and you only get so much back from it, you know? So it's not a very efficient food. It's a good food. Not saying don't do it, but it's not as efficient. Drinks are way more efficient. So when I'm working hard, especially I'm working a full-time manual labor job and I have to come home and still have energy to work out. And half the year it's really hot outside. So if I'm not energetic and hydrated after a long, hard day of manual labor out in the heat, I'm not going to have a good workout. So my diet isn't for everybody, but for me and my circumstance, I had to maximize everything just as ridiculously in order to come home on a 90 degree day after working out in the heat all day and be hydrated still and have the energy to go do a world-class workout. So it worked really well for me. Might work well for others, but it's definitely not for everybody.
I take about two mass gainer shakes a day. Now I'm not using all organic substances like you. I'm taking in a company where it's got 25 grams of protein, 125 grams of carbohydrates and creatine in it. Nothing crazy, maltodextrin. And I rip through it and I can literally hit workouts and it just digests quickly. I smash the workout. I take it again. I mix in wheatgrass powder, Shilajit, everything into my drinks on top of all of it. So it has all of these enhanced organic substances. But as far as the core principle of the shake, it is just very basic carbohydrates, basic whey. And I rip through the thing. And I can't even begin to tell you, like I'm working out on these machines and like I'm bending the metal when I'm ripping into this thing and I keep on getting stronger. And I used to be the guy when I was younger where I got really into the paleo thing and I was like, I'm a caveman CrossFitter, and I'd be eating a whole rotisserie chicken, two pounds of steak a day. And I still love that, don't get me wrong, but I'm having about 3 to 4 pounds of meat a day and it would just keep on messing up my gut. As I've gotten older, I get further and further away from that stuff as I'm training more intensely. And now I just am almost all shakes. Like in the morning, I start out with coffee and honey. And then I'll go work out. As soon as I get done, I have one of my superhero shakes, is what I call it, or macho man shakes. Then I get to have a solid lunch. Then I pass out for a couple hours. And then I will wake up again, have another superhero shake. And then I'll have a solid dinner. But there's only really two substantially solid meals a day, much like you said. And our puzzles are shaped a little bit differently, but for the most part, it's the same.
Yeah, the general concept is the same. Yeah, it's efficient. The drinks are just efficient. they take little energy to digest, but they give a lot back.
Well, it's interesting. Like the way that the industry is going these days, there's so much of this biohacking industry. There's all these like new fads that are coming out and they're trying to push people to take all these really extreme products, really extreme diets, all of these things. And every single time I sit down with a world-class athlete, a world-class performer, there's nothing that crazy. They're actually pretty simple. And a lot of the questions we ended up getting in here, a lot of people want to know if you had like carte blanche, you could have whatever you want and any amount of money, any amount of food, any amount of equipment. Is there anything you would have done differently with your career knowing what you know now? Like, would you have had saunas, ice baths? Would you have had red light therapy? Would you have, you know, certain kind of like, I don't know. Anything you could imagine? Is there anything you would add to your training, or do you think you did it just the way you needed to?
Oh, shoot. Good question. I mean, honestly, I would have loved to have not had to work a manual labor job. And then I could have trained twice a day instead of once.
That's luxury, Hobie. Let's talk about the real stuff.
But other than that, not really. I mean, sure, I would have bought a nicer treadmill, but that wouldn't have really mattered that much. Honestly, I could do what I did on it. You know, I would have bought new shoes more often, you know, little things like that, that just a little more money could have got me. But the general idea, nothing would have changed. No.
Yeah.
I liked what I was doing. I found a way to make it work.
None of these $20,000 sauna / ice bath houses to help.
Possibly. But honestly, yeah. A good hot shower or just a good hot run out in 95 degrees and a little $50 trough with some cold water in it gets the job done. It might not look glamorous, but it gets the same job done.
How do you feel about today's new generation? Like, I...
Under what context do you mean exactly?
Well, no. I'm talking about from an athletic standpoint. we could get into some really gnarly conversations, probably for a different table, a different time.
The carbon-plated shoes you talking?
Yeah, so like I really don't want to create a rift here between you and your son, but your son versus you, both of you in your prime, who's winning that fight?
You mean Hawk? Is that Hawk, what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, not creating rifts, but I got him beat.
There you go. That's all I want to hear. Now, do you think that has to do with him, his talent, or it has to do with today's version of training and mindset? Go.
I actually think it has more to do with age. He still has time to catch up and be better than me. I think genetically, I think physically, he has a better body. If he ends up being as determined as me and sticks with it, I think he'll figure it out and he'll probably be better than I ever was.
But that's part of the question that I have for you. Do you think today's generation still has the guts to do that? Or do you think things are starting to change where people are kind of starting to drift away from that hard work and some of those hours where you're having to sell your TV to go to a race and all that kind of stuff? Like, is that starting to fade?
I would say amongst the general population, definitely. General population isn't looking to make their lives harder and more difficult. But I would say it's actually the opposite for those who are really serious. The real serious people, I think, are every bit as committed as we ever were, and they've got more tools in their disposal. So it might be a smaller crowd that's super dedicated, but I think they still absolutely exist, and I think they're going to outdo us. Like you see records breaking and being broken in sports right now. Like, the best of the best are better than we ever were. You know, and you can credit shoes and stuff like that as part of it, but it doesn't matter. Like, they're still putting in the work.
Yeah.
So there's still people out there who are as committed as ever and willing to do whatever it takes, no doubt about it.
Yeah. I do want to get to talking about your new endeavor, Shilajit. I'm always kind of stalking you without you knowing it. I'm like, what's Hobie up to? What's he doing that I don't know about that could make me better? I probably have bugs in your house that you don't even know about that I'm listening to everything that you're doing. And, you know, you got me on honey. You got me on wheatgrass. I got wheatgrass I put in all my shakes. And a couple years ago, Shilajit started to really pop up. And I think maybe even before that, I heard you mention it, but I wasn't maybe paying it close enough attention. But now... Shilajit is on ads all over the internet. Everybody I know has got a little tincture around them. I want to know how you got into it, where you learned about it, and how all of a sudden you, of all of the things you've ever been involved in, this was the one that you wanted to put your name behind to start a business. Tell me all about it.
All right. What actually?
It's a food source?
Well, he's going to tell you.
It's a food supplement, yes. A real simple way of explaining it. It's a mineral supplement. But it's a very unique one, though. We'll get into that a little bit. But I actually learned about Shilajit years and years ago, just with my general studying of nutrition in general. So I'd used it on and off a few times many years ago. But being expensive and being poor, I never really stuck with it full time. But yeah, my interest in Shilajit, it comes about from my desire to be the best. You know, like I said, I was 10 years old and I decided I wanted to be the best at something. So I spent my entire life spending a great deal of time and effort and energy trying to be the best. And when I retired from racing, you know, all of a sudden that desire just didn't go away. You know, I didn't have anywhere to put it. So I was kind of like a lost soul, honestly. And so anyways, years go by. And it was actually my brother. He was one of the very first people to discover that Shilajit existed in the U.S. in our Rocky Mountains, because in most of the world, just thinks it's mostly in the Himalayas, you know, in the Chinese, India regions of the world. And well, he discovered it here, and he went and he invited me to go search for it just in the mountains near where I live. And so we're out there, and we actually found some. And I was like, man, how cool is that? That Shilajit exists right here in my own backyard. You know, I'd never fathomed that idea. And so that sparked my interest. And so I started studying. I'm like, well, shoot, if it exists here, you know, how do you actually turn this from a rock on the mountain into a finished Shilajit product? How do people do that? You know, so I started studying. And the more I studied, the more I realized people don't, that the companies selling this are using pretty old-fashioned methods to produce a finished product. And I was like, I think I could do better. I think I could create a better product than what anybody else is doing. So I studied more, and the more I studied, the more I became convinced that I could create a superior product. And it was that idea of I could be the best at something again. I could create something that's the best. You know, that's actually what got me interested. If I was just going to be like all the other companies out there, I don't think I would have been interested at all. But it was this idea that I could be the best at something again in my life. And so. So I decided to test it. I had these ideas. I could purify this like nobody else purifies. I could create a better product. And so I did. So I started working a bunch of overtime at work. I bought a bunch of equipment and did a whole bunch of testing and like a bunch of trial and error stuff. And I did it. I accomplished. I created what I thought I could create. And I truly believe, like on our bottle, it says the world's purest, most potent Shilajit. Like, that's not just a fancy tagline. That was actually my motivation to do this, was to create the world's best Shilajit. And I believe I accomplished that, and that's what got me excited. So that's why I decided to start a business selling it. I thought if I can do this, why not? And it's such a unique product. That's part of what makes it so cool. There's nothing out there like Shilajit.
So out of curiosity, from the time that you leave your house to go up into the mountains to finding it, to abstracting it, and getting back to your house, and then processing it, and then having it in a bottle, how many hours would you say that takes?
Oh, goodness. A lot. I mean, I can spend days just looking for it until I find some sometimes. You know, sometimes you'll go up and find a spot, and you're like, oh, nice, right there. And I don't even have to use ropes or climbing equipment to get to it. But other times you'll spend 2 days and not find anything. So that's a hard question to answer. But in general, I'd say I'm spending at least 20 hours just to find a chunk I can get. And then, of course, you got to get it home, and you might have to go get climbing equipment. So I'll go up and find it. Then I'll come back and get climbing equipment, and I'll go back up to get it. And then I got to carry it all the way home. And then, you know, it takes me about a week to purify it, the purification process.
Can I ask a question? Is it a root? Is it like a?
It looks like a rock. It looks like a rock. On the mountain, it's a black rock. It looks like this.
Huh.
That's huge.
Could you bite a chunk of that off, or would it break your teeth?
Oh, it'll break your teeth. It's pretty hard. It's solid.
I'd walk right past that. I'd be like, oh, it's a rock.
Oh, yeah.
It's not dense like a rock. It's almost like a hardened composite.
It's a resin. So it's solid. It is pretty much dense like a rock, but it's water soluble. If I put this in water, the Shilajit will dissolve into the water. And that's actually how it's purified, because this has a whole bunch of sand and little chunks of rock and other stuff. Like, it's been on the ledge of a cliff for 1,000 years. You know, it's got stuff in it. So you got to purify it. The way to purify it is mix it with water, and it'll dissolve. And then you can use water filters to filter out the things you don't want in it. So anyways, yeah, that's what it looks like. But it you'll only find it in the ledges and nooks and crannies of cliffs, because if water gets on it, then it'll just dissolve away. And so a lot of times you find some, but it's 50 foot up a cliff, so you got to figure out how the heck to get up there and get it. So I've got all sorts of Shilajit I've found that I don't have any idea how I'm going to get it. But every once in a while, you're able to find your way and climb up a cliff and get it off of there. So that's a fun process, but it can be time consuming. Anyway, yeah.
Where so how much would That thing's probably the size of a baseball, maybe a little bit bigger.
Yeah.
How much would that create? How many bottles would that create?
Well, see, this one probably weighs about a pound. Yeah. And it's probably about maybe 30% actual shilajit. The rest is just sand and rocks and other stuff.
Yeah.
So you get, you know, let's just say you get 100 grams out of it. That'll make 120 grams and make 20 bottles. So 20 to 30 bottles in that much shilajit.
I'm asking you all these questions because a lot of people are like, you know, what's so special about Hobies? And I think like the most important thing for people to understand is like, listen to this story. Like, this isn't just somebody who purchased a product online and then slapped a label on it. You know, I'll tell you, when we create our products, like I specifically created these blends and we'll batch test them back and forth for flavoring, for response. We'll change the ingredients a little bit. But I am not going into the mountains to go find you guys BCAAs. And I'm not going into the mountains to go get you guys creatine. I'm not going into the mountains to go find you guys beta-alanine. Like, sure, we have a very stable and awesome business, but this is a true story of somebody who's, it's an art matched with an incredible product. And this is why I personally, I'll give you an example. A couple of years ago, I was at Spartan Race. There was a man there who got half eaten by a bear. And I don't know if you ever heard about this. The guy got attacked by a grizzly bear twice in one day. And now in his head, his head is like half missing and stuff. And he's a knife company. It's called Big Sky Blades. And I was like, you're incredible. Like, I want to buy a knife from a guy that literally survived and then all of a sudden decided to create an art around his pain and his experience to make beautiful blades. You, on the other hand, same exact thing. There's this incredible journey of a world champion who now took his obsession with excellence to go into the mountains, find something that's incredibly rare and bountiful and healthy for people to take, and then bring it back down from the mountains in the most extreme and random places in Utah, which usually doesn't even exist in the United States. It's too hard to find. And then you create a product and then it ends up in your home and you're taking it. Like, that's the beauty of the story behind what you do. And it fascinated me when I found out that you were doing that. I was like, whoa. That's a real adventure.
Yeah, that's the one. I mean, maybe it's a little too bold or bragging too much to make your own claims to fame, but you know, like mine is, you know, from getting it on the mountain to the whole finished bottle that's labeled and sealed and everything. Like, I do it all. Like, I go up and I find it. I'm the one that resources it. I developed my own purification system for it through trial and error. I purify it myself. You know, and then I freeze dry it, and then I bottle it, I package it, I put that seal on it. You know, it never leaves my hands until it gets to that point. And to me, that's important, because if I'm going to claim to have the best, how can I source it from China and then just finish it there and say I have the best? I don't know how it got to the point it was. I don't know who sourced it. I don't know what quality it was on the mountain when they pulled it off, you know. Yep. And so if I'm going to make claims like that, I need to be able to verify them. So I have to do everything myself to do that. So it was the excitement to be able to go out in my backyard, my mountains where I live, and get it myself and then do it all myself. That to me was very exciting. And I agree.
Is it a mental clarity type of sub? You said it's an oil, or you drop it in your water. So how does it help you health wise? Like, what's his name? Shane says, hey, I use this. I help it. I feel it helping to wake up my nerves. Is it like a neuro, like it helps you think more clear?
It can be. I've and you can go online and hear what people say, but I like to use my own customers' personal experiences. And I've got two people who just straight up said it helps to clear up my brain fog.
Huh.
You know, and so it can have different effects on different people depending on what nutrients your body needs and it provides that you don't already have. So it will have different effects on different people. But a real simple way, I mean, it's a very unique product. It has a lot of different nutrients in it. You don't even know how to say the name of the nutrient, let alone know what it does, you know. But in a real simple way is it's like Mother Nature's super mineral supplement. And minerals could do all sorts of things. You know how like you have iron-related anemia issues. You know, yeah. Almost 3 people just in America alone have anemia from low iron levels. And, you know, iron is just one of dozens of minerals that you know that exist in this. And but not only that, it's like a lot of people have anemia. Let's just use that one as an example, the iron. Yeah. Right, A lot of people have anemia because they don't eat enough iron, but a lot of people do eat enough, but their body doesn't absorb it. They have digestion issues or something. Their body doesn't really absorb the iron out of the foods they eat. Well, there's Shilajit's decomposed down to its most basic nutrients. So like it's the ionic minerals. So these minerals don't have to go through the normal digestion process of normal foods. It doesn't have to go through the digestive tract and the liver and whatnot to be digested. It's the type of thing you put under your tongue and it'll just absorb right into your body and get utilized. And then not only does it have those minerals in ionic form, but it has fulvic acid, which helps transport nutrients into your body, you know? So you eat this and maybe you got anemia because you're low on iron. It'll give you that actual iron, but it'll absorb when other methods won't, because your body can't digest it. So we've had multiple people with anemia related issues. So one person was getting shots every month or so because that was the only way they could get their iron levels up. The others were they just weren't eating enough, most likely. And they take this and their iron levels go up when nothing else had ever worked before. So far we have 100% success story on that. So someday I plan to do an official study or something to see how well this really works among the population. But anyway, like I say, that's just one mineral. The other minerals have other problems. So that's a real basic. There are more to it than just its minerals. But anyway, yeah.
I remember watching one of those like National Geographic shows, and they were tracking this mountain goat. And so I thought this was so fascinating. It really kicked off my brain. Like, maybe I should think about this more. They're like, this mountain goat needs to get to where it's going. And like, where is she going? Why is she going there? And like, she's going through the mountains and like just treacherous, insane terrain for days on end, not stopping to eat anything, just going and going and going. They're like, where is she going? What does she need so much? And they show her all these like times where the mountain goat almost falls to its death. Like, it's just exhaustingly hunting for this thing. And it finally gets there and like, she's found it. Oh, here it comes. And then she just goes up and just starts licking this rock. And it was a mineral rock. And it was deficient on minerals to the point where this animal knew so much so that it knew that it was going to become sick, deficient, or die if it didn't fight feverishly to get to this mineral rock and keep on licking it. And it went days through this like insane mountainous terrain, like way harder than what we do for races. And I was just like, what the hell? Like, this thing almost killed itself to go lick this rock. And it probably licked the rock for like 2 hours, something creepy like that. But in reality, like, our bodies are deficient in things. And I think a lot of people don't necessarily pay attention to the underlying deficiencies that a lot of bodies have. And it's pretty insane to me that even as I get older, there's pieces of my life where I'm like, man, I'll give you an example. I just went into the mountains. I went hiking and I got really sick off of the water. And I spent about 12 weeks afterwards shitting my brains out. And then afterwards, there was something wrong with my body. And I actually had to go back through and reset my gut through all of these pills that I was taking to get my skin and everything back to normal. Like, I never would have thought about that. And there's just one little deficiency going on in your body that's cascading all of these terrible effects that are going on the rest of your life. And I couldn't get rid of it. And it took was this one moment of bad behavior, drinking crappy water, to months of issues. And now I'm finally back on the other side where I'm not having issues anymore. But I'm supposing that products like yours are going to be some of the things that people need to start taking and putting into their routine more often to enhance their lifestyle so that they can do everything else like racing, living, loving.
Do you want to hear what I thought? U.S. Shilajit, my first thought without knowing anything about what we just talked about, I thought it was like some type of Brazilian jiu-jitsu. Like, it had the word jit in it. I was like, oh, he's rolling on the floor, like doing, hold up moves, let alone, I had no idea it was a health supplement. That's where my mind went. I'm glad we talked about it.
Yeah. Most people have no idea. They're like, Sheila, what? You know? And yeah, it's an Indian word. So it just doesn't wrap in our mind.
Legit to quit. Yeah. Maybe it's a song.
Well, we're getting up to our hour mark, and I kind of want to we're going to do some rapid fire questions, but out of curiosity, man, like, are you done? Is there anything left out there on the table that you want? I mean, you have the lunge world record. You have many Spartan Race world championships. You've gone undefeated many seasons. you know, I know you had your ambitions of running like even a sub 2 hour marathon at one point. Like, is there anything left that you just are thinking about?
Or do you want to come to High Rocks this year and take the world record from him? Or
I'd split you in half, Obi. I'd tear your spine right out of your body and wear it like a necklace.
Yeah, it probably would. Oh, I couldn't even tell you how many times in the last 6 years I wanted to come out of retirement in one form or another and go run a race. I think those days are probably over. Just stay healthy and fit enough to go run around the mountains and get Sheila Jeep. If I'm that healthy, I'll be happy. We'll see. Who knows? If I business goes well enough, I quit my normal job and I have more time and energy, I might try to make a second run at something.
But yeah, I probably think you can still set the pull-up world record. The guys who are doing it have so much more body mass than you. They don't have the strength endurance that you have. I think if I would fund you doing you think, the 24-hour pull-up world record, you just wear that well huge verse, jet shirt.
How well would he versus Michael Eckert?
Oh, dude, he would destroy Michael Eckert. Ooh. I like Michael a lot.
Yeah, he's great.
But I'm just going to be downright honest. I wouldn't be talking about this. There's just like this guy, Justin Truitt, I think he's Cameron Haynes' son. There's all of these guys. Like if I had to take my entire, they're like, Hunter, like you have to put your life on the line for Hobie to go set the record on this thing. I would put my head under a guillotine and eat popcorn watching him set the record by probably an extra 20%. I don't have a doubt in my mind. I tried to get him to do it years ago and he's like, hey man, I need someone to fund it. And I was like, let me think. I think even at your age of 46 years old, your strength endurance is probably as good as it's ever been. It's just probably whether or not your body can actually hold up the amount of reps, but you could set the pull-up world record in a heartbeat. 24 hours. You might not have the elasticity.
I won't deny it. I would need to be focused and put in the training. We'll see if I ever do, but potential. I think I do have that potential still. No doubt about it.
Every time you have a shake, just do 200 to 500 pull-ups and you bang it out. Okay. I want to rapid fire because there were a lot of people asking questions and I feel like it's the nice thing to do to give these people the time of day of a little bit of Hobie. Oh man, who's this handsome guy in this picture? Okay. Give me a second here, ladies and gentlemen. Oh shoot. Is it gone? I am such a dummy. All right, I'll go to these ones.
We gone past the 24 hours?
Yeah, I did. Went past the 24 hours. But we got a bunch in here. We got a bunch here. Do. People want to know, when you were in your prime, and I won't be hurt if it's not me, who was your toughest competition? I have a guess who.
Well, the truth is, it's different to people for different races. But just generally speaking, Cody Moat, when he was having a good day. When he was having a good day, he worried me the most.
Yeah, there's nothing you could do. I think one time we all raced. I don't know if you were there. We did a Breckenridge race, and he beat everybody by 9 minutes. Like, nobody had done that. Like, we were all within 2 to 4 minutes of each other at the finish line. Next person was 9 minutes behind.
Yeah, his career was pretty roller coastered, but his good days were really good days. He was amazing.
Is there anybody you had who is a role model? Somebody that were like, I look up to this person, I learn from this person.
I would even say Cody Moat for that. He's just not just a great athlete. He was a great individual, wonderful character, and good people like Joshua Zwanitzer. Most people don't know who that is, but I just like good people with good moral values and whatnot. And I mean, but it depends on the situation. I mean, you were definitely a role model in a lot of ways. What the things you've been able to do against the odds, you know, I was stunned that someone so big and so strong could do so well. And a lot of times that motivated me to not to worry about gaining 5 more pounds. I'm like, oh, Hunter can do it. I can do it. You know, so a lot of different role models for different reasons, you know?
Yep. I appreciate you saying that.
You seem like a very happy-go-lucky kind of guy.
The happiest.
Like, yeah. One of the like most upbeat, like you could just get told that half your house was had a skylight sized hole and all of it flooded and you'd be like, well, it'll give me time to like paddle through it and get a workout in. You just seem like a very happy go lucky kind of guy. I like it.
I'm back and forth. Like I say, you see me in my good moments. So yeah. I have my normal human moments, but in general, yeah, why not? I mean, we're going through life. You might as well go through it smiling.
Well, I want to thank you for being a pillar in my life. I want to thank you for being somebody that never gave me doubt. Even when I was in the mud and I'd lost you, you always told me I was incredible. You never, ever once gave me any negative, downtrodden speech ever. You always tell me I was special, even when I was trying to beat you every single day, every single second of my entire life. And I'm glad that we met. I am who I am today because of you. And I think a lot of people can lean on this knowing that Hobie will be a pillar in my life for many years to come. And I think that everybody needs to find somebody like Hobie, even in whatever aspect of life that you're in. You have to have somebody to look up to live with, to compete against, but also to measure yourself in a positive way. You know, I knew that if I was racing against you and I didn't beat you, I was still, if I was getting close, that was good for me. That was good for me at the time. And now I look back at those moments so fondly when I had nothing, but it meant everything. And now I have everything. And sometimes it means nothing, if you get what I mean. And it's tough. It's tough to say that in all honesty, because I have grown knowing that my life will change and everybody's lives will change. And those are the richest probably moments of my entire career, were spending time with you in superhero scrambles in Georgia and random places, gator infested water, when, you know, the budget was cheap, but the enthusiasm was high. And I'm very grateful, man. And I'm hoping that you, your family, your business thrive. If there's anything we can do to help, anybody who's listening to this, guys, like if you're seeing stuff on the internet and you are interested in a project like Sheila Jit, like I think you should really buy into a brand rather than a product. Like this is a man. This is a man who has a dream and has a true enthusiasm. And you know that every single aspect of the process is put and built by his hands at the highest quality. And that's what I believe in as a person. I buy into people, not necessarily brands or labels or any of that kind of stuff. So Hobie, we're going to see this thing get off and we're looking forward to seeing your success.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, man. Tell the family I say hi also. Tell Hawk that I'm also very grateful that he got me through the very end of my hardest race in my entire life.
Yeah, he talks about that often, actually.
I was so miserable. Your son and his friend saved me. I was like, yeah. I want to go home. Like, I was almost in tears at one point.
Is his son part of the Beater Boys?
No. So the Beater Boys were our crew.
Yeah.
I was loosely texting his son. He's like, I'll come help. They found me on the mountain and ran me the last 10 miles.
Wow.
And it was when the sun was fading. I couldn't see anything. I mean, I have nothing against the race, but they did such a terrible job marking the course that it was your son who got me to the finish line. God dang, man. I'm grateful. Yeah. And he beat me. He beat me. My last Spartan race, he beat me. I'm a little bit out of Spartan shape, but don't make me come back. Brother, thank you for your time. Yeah. Everybody, thank you for your morning. Ryan, I'll catch you soon, brother. Hobie, until next time, my friend.
Yeah. Thanks again.
Thank you. Thank you. Later, we'll guys. See you soon. Yep. And we are.